Good morning. May it please the court.
Mr. Riley.
I'm Patrick Deaton. I represent Casey Peebles. I'm here today representing appellant who's asking this court to set aside his two drug convictions after a jury trial and enter judgments of acquittal based on insufficiency of the evidence, or in the alternative for relief, to order a new trial as a result of four evidentiary rulings that the trial court made. I'd like to begin with the first issue in appellant's brief having to do with Federal Rule of Evidence 801D2E involving the so-called co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule. Casey Peebles' conviction depended on the testimony of Quanti Harris, a co-defendant in this case. He was a member of the Randers conspiracy to distribute drugs in St. Louis. He wasn't a family member, but most of the people in the conspiracy were members of the Randers family in one way or another. The central events in the case have to do with Casey Peebles' arrest on the night of April 2nd, 2013, here in the city of St. Louis. Prior to April 2nd, that night, Quanti Harris had never seen Casey Peebles. But the district court allowed Quanti Harris to testify about events on the night of April 2nd. And this allowed Quanti Harris to testify about matters that Joseph Rander told Quanti Harris. Joseph Rander never testified at the trial. And why this is so important is because without what Quanti Harris claims to have learned from Joseph Rander, there isn't sufficient evidence to convict Casey Peebles on the conspiracy count.
Maybe you're going to answer that the conspiracy is different, but there was testimony that he was seen, Mr. Peebles was seen going into this residence at a particular time, came back out, there was a traffic stop, there were drugs that were ultimately linked to him. So is that enough to link him to the conspiracy if there's sufficient evidence to show the jury that he actually purchased drugs from that location or was fronted drugs?
No. For this reason, I'm going to assume your facts for purposes of the question. If he had gone there to obtain drugs, which he denied, he testified in this case and said that wasn't why I was there, that wouldn't put him in a conspiracy. That could simply be a buyer-seller relationship. Quanti Harris testified about what Joseph Rander said, those events weren't in furtherance of the conspiracy. Quanti Harris said that Joseph Rander told him after Casey Peebles had left that Joseph Rander, sold him 9 ounces of heroin. And it's our contention that the judge didn't properly apply the test for 801-2.
So are you saying that the statements themselves are the only evidence of the conspiracy? The disputed statements from Mr. Rander are the only evidence of a conspiracy involving Peebles?
Well, the fact that he's there, mere presence doesn't convict him of a conspiracy. The fact that he's at that house. And the the courts require evidence in just what you're asking about, independent evidence, evidence that's independent of the statements themselves, to establish the existence of the conspiracy. And in this case, the law enforcement first started investigating this case at least as early as the fall of 2011. From the fall of 2011 until April 2nd of 2013, despite use of informants, PIN registers, trap and trace devices, surveillance, the officers had no idea that Casey Peoples had anything to do with the Randers. So if this was a case where Casey Peoples had been seen at that address before, or his phone number had shown up in a PIN register or with a trap and trace device, that would be a different story. But the evidence of his conspiracy in this case comes from what Quanti Harris claims to have learned from Joseph Rander.
If the record established independent evidence to support the conspiracy, people's involvement in the conspiracy, would you concede that the statements made by Rander were statements in furtherance of that conspiracy?
No.
I mean, assuming that the conspiracy has been properly established for purposes of the evidentiary rule.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't concede that.
Why is that? Why would that not be a statement in furtherance of the conspiracy?
Well, what Quanti Harris said about what Joseph Rander said, that was just historical. The transaction had already occurred. It was over. It didn't advance the conspiracy in any way.
So is there evidence put on as to the meaning of twins people coming through, what that phrase means, or what the language used by or quoted by Harris attributed to Rander as to what those phrases meant in the drug trade or in furtherance of the conspiracy?
Judge Smith, if I understand your question correctly, I thought Mr. Harris's statements about what Rander said were pretty clear. And he named an amount, 9 ounces, and he said heroin. Did I misunderstand your question?
Sorry. Just proceed.
I think that where I'm having a little bit of trouble with that particular testimony is that I understand that Mr. Harris said that he said twin people be fitting to come through. We fitting to be on. We fitting to be back together. And that talks about a relationship of some kind, which put in context as it all kind of fits together may infer some relationship tying in Peoples to some other ongoing relationship. Is that not what he was saying? Was he saying something different? Was there something else going on there?
Judge, my answer is no. The quote, one of twins people is coming, we fitting to be on again, something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that doesn't say Casey Peoples. Okay. And there was no explanation in this trial of who twin was or who twins people were. There was no connection of Casey Peoples to twin, or that he was one of that Casey Peoples was one of twins people. They'd been investigating this group for a long time, and there was no evidence of that.
You mentioned as well that at most it might look like a buyer-seller relationship. And is it legally significant that there is a deliverable quantity of drugs that's discovered in the ultimate search and arrest?
Well, on the second count, mm-hmm. Mr. Peoples was convicted of possession with the intent to distribute, and the amount of heroin was more than a personal use. Was more than a personal use amount. What I wanted to tell the court about that is I'm not an economist, but even though drugs are expensive, it doesn't mean they're scarce. So 9 ounces of heroin, the street price of that, according to testimony at trial, would be maybe around $20,000, but that doesn't mean that heroin was so scarce that it was unlikely that, this heroin could have come from somewhere else if it didn't come from the apartment that the Randers had been using to distribute drugs. I want to talk about the issue of allowing a veteran police officer to testify as an expert on drug trafficking. I realize that the admission of evidence that is, the standard of review is abuse of discretion. But appellant's argument is that the judge abused his discretion in this particular case by not doing the kind of reliability determination that Rule 702 requires. In other words, in some cases, it might be perfectly appropriate for an expert to testify about the nature of drug trafficking. But that doesn't mean that the expert could testify about all matters in connection with drug trafficking without being qualified as to a particular matter. So testifying about how someone can make methamphetamine with items that can be purchased at the drugstore or a hardware store doesn't qualify that person to testify about other matters in connection with the drug business unless the court makes a reliability determination. Otherwise, the officers may just be testifying based on stereotypes attributable to people. Similarly, in not allowing him to testify and not allowing me to cross-examine about the World Series ticket scandal, well, maybe in other cases it was proper to prohibit cross-examination of officers regarding that, but not in this case. The officer's credibility was key, and in my reply brief, I tried to explain why the admission of that would have been a cross-examination in this case, where in the Beck case it might not have been cross-examination. I want to save a little time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Deaton. Mr. Riley?
May it please the court. Good morning. May it please co-counsel or counsel opposing counsel in this case. I'll start with the first issue and raise them in the order as they were addressed by Mr. Deaton, if that pleases the court. As to the first issue, the admissibility of the co-conspirator statements, I just ask the court to keep in mind the bell finding procedure that was undertaken in this case. Mr. Deaton engaged in aggressive and diligent motion practice in this case. He filed a motion challenging the admissibility of the anticipated co-conspirator statements, and those were the subject of at least raised by the witness himself when he testified at a pretrial motion hearing in relation to a motion to suppress identification. So everybody knew what the statements were going to be. We were in front of a very experienced district court judge. And as we do in any case, when we presented the proof in the case, we attempted to do so in a linear fashion, but also in anticipation of making a sufficient record for Judge Weber to make Bell findings. So the court had heard substantial evidence of the existence of the conspiracy through five other witnesses who testified before Mr. Harris. That included an admitted co-conspirator, Marnina James, who testified, among other things, that Joseph Rander was a principal in the conspiracy and that the property at issue here, 5911 Highland, was a drug distribution point for the Rander organization. Ms. James' credibility was established in part through multiple seizures in which she was implicated. One was a drug trafficking incident in which approximately a kilogram of cocaine was seized in September of 2011. Then in August of 2012, she was caught in two separate incidents with both United States currency, $60,000 in California, and then transporting 2 kilos of cocaine from California to St. Louis, and she was caught in Albuquerque. So the court had heard that. They'd also heard that Leah Douglas testified. She was Casey Peoples' 20-year-old girlfriend. He was 40 at the time. He was more sophisticated, and he used, and when I say used, I mean used her to hold his narcotics. They had an established drug trafficking relationship. She testified that Mr. Peoples, who was on parole, was a drug dealer, and she held his narcotics for him. She was entirely aware that he was a drug dealer. So keep that in mind in relation to the buyer-seller argument that was raised here. But
that evidence doesn't include Peoples into the Rander conspiracy.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So is it? I mean, it seems like the nub of the concern here for the defendant is that, all right, so, well, I'm not going to speak for them, but it seems to me that if you say, okay, there's a conspiracy, they've proven up sufficient evidence of a conspiracy to for the purposes of co-conspirator statements, but the only way you get Mr. Peoples in is through a co-conspirator statement of a conspiracy he may not be involved in.
Thank you, Your Honor, if I may address that. So if proof of a formal agreement is unnecessary and an applied understanding is sufficient under Helscher to prove the existence of a conspiracy and his involvement in it, let's look at the facts that we have absent Quante Harris's statements, which are the statements of Joseph Rander that he made to Quante Harris both before and after the narcotics deal here. Let's look at the facts in terms of what's circumstantial. And when we look at Young, I'll cite Young for the proposition that's raised in our brief. And when we talk about independent evidence, Young at 771, independent evidence of a conspiracy or illicit association may be completely circumstantial, citing Martin. So let's cut the words out for a minute and look at the conduct. We have Casey Peoples showing up late in the late evening hours. He's driving his vehicle. Vernon Westcott and Leah Douglas are with him. The only person here who has any resources, any financial resources, is Casey Peoples. For all intents and purposes, Leah Douglas has to get clothes from Casey Peoples' family and friends, and Vernon Westcott doesn't even have a car. So Casey Peoples shows up at a drug house. From there, that is something that supports the existence of an agreement. He enters the drug house. He takes a quarter kilogram of cocaine, heroin. What we know later is a quarter kilo of heroin, but Quante Harris also witnessed the drug transaction itself. Setting aside the statements for a minute, he witnessed Joseph Rander deliver heroin to Peoples. Then almost immediately after he exits the residence, and Peoples was the only person in the vehicle to enter the residence. That's unequivocally established from the record. So then he gets in his car. Westcott's in the front seat. Douglas is in the back seat. They basically drive to the end of the block, make a right, and the police curb the vehicle. As Officer Witzman approaches the vehicle, he sees movement, and he sees Leah Douglas appearing. She's sitting in the back seat, and she appears to be stuffing something into her pants, which she admitted when she testified.
Was her testimony that that bag that she stuffed in her pants was not in the car until after Peoples came?
To her knowledge, Your Honor, the inferences to be raised were that Peoples walked into the residence. He was the only person to go in. And then in accord with their standard, she said when we got pulled over, I knew what was going to happen. If there was drugs, it was coming to me because my job was to hold it, essentially. That's not verbatim, but that's the essence of her testimony. So the inference that the jury found, Your Honor, was that he obtained the narcotics when he went into the residence and that was not in the vehicle before Peoples entered the residence. Then when they were pulled over, Douglas did not say that she saw Peoples hand the narcotics to Westcott, but she did see Westcott hand it to her. She put it in her on her person, and then the female officer searched her and located the quarter kilogram of heroin. So Judge Weber had heard all this evidence, and he also heard Quante Harris testify to the fact that Peoples delivered the strike, that Rander, Joseph Rander, delivered the heroin to Peoples before he ever made a ruling on the Bell findings.
Did Harris know how much it was?
Harris didn't know how much it was. What Harris knew before the fact, Your Honor, what he told the police when he notified them, what brought them to watch these events and set up a surveillance, was Harris's phone call that Joseph Rander, who I believe he referred to as Breezy, was at 5911 Highland, and he had a kilogram of heroin.
And Harris had been working with the officers through
Harris
this.
Harris is working with the officers.
Longer conspirator.
He's no longer a conspirator. That's correct, Your Honor. But and if I may, if I've answered that question, I would like to move on to why the statements are in furtherance of the conspiracy and the independent evidence of the existence of the conspiracy. And so I guess in one respect, I say the obvious. He showed up at a known drug house, and a quarter kilogram of heroin was removed from a person who was in his vehicle, Leah Douglas. That's independent evidence. And as Mock and Young, that conspiracy case suggests, it can be entirely circumstantial evidence of the independent evidence of the existence of the conspiracy. The officers watched Peoples enter the residence, exit the residence. Within moments, they conducted a car stop and discovered a quarter kilogram of heroin. Then Leah Douglas testified to her standard procedure that Peoples is a dope deal. She holds this dope for him because he says you're less likely to get searched. You're a woman. And then the police recover a quarter kilogram of heroin within moments of watching Peoples enter and exit the residence. So that is significant independent evidence of the existence of an implied agreement. And then in terms of so the street value is also $15,000 to $18,000. There is some kind of agreement there. Basic drug dealing tenets support that this is not a charity. If you take it, you either pay up front or you're going to pay later. That's a reasonable inference for the jury to draw. In terms of whether the statements...
And there was no exchange of money at that time.
There's no evidence of that, Your Honor. Mr. Harris testified they didn't witness an exchange of money. And then when he came back up from letting Peoples out the door of 5911 Highland, that's when he stated Joseph Rander said he fronted 9 ounces of heroin. I'd like to touch on why both those statements, the ones before the deal and after the deal, including the 9 ounces, are in furtherance. Of course, when Mr. Joseph Rander, who's a conspirator, tells Harris that somebody's coming over, he needs to work the door, go down, he's coming, and it's twins, people we're fixing to be back on, something to that effect, he's facilitating a drug deal. He's also providing for the security of the conspiracy by having a doorman there to provide security. And he's telling the doorman it's okay to let this guy in. And let's talk about those statements for a moment after the deal. 9 ounces. I fronted 9 ounces. Well, for one thing that does, it tells Quante Harris that there's still a quantity of heroin in the residence. We still have heroin. There was a kilogram. He took 9 ounces. So he knows there's still something in the residence they need to protect, and allows Joseph Rander to continue to protect the heroin that remains in the residence. He also confirmed that the defendant, Peoples, for future dealings, he's in the conspiracy. I fronted him 9 ounces. This deal went down. He's a part of the conspiracy now. The other thing it does, you can make a finding that it supports an accounting function for the conspiracy. The Joseph Rander's motive to make statements doesn't end right there. This is an ongoing drug conspiracy. As the 5 or 6 subsequent seizures that we introduced evidence of in the trial, all based on information from Quante Harris, by the way, those reflect the ongoing nature of the conspiracy. There's an accounting function. they have a kilogram of heroin. That's 9 ounces. That guy has 9 ounces. What you can find from that is he needs to pay us, or it helps Joseph Rander arguably keep track of who has what. So it furthers the conspiracy in multiple respects. And in addition, I think Judge Erickson did touch on something, that the relationship with twins people refers to some type of relationship, an existing relationship. You don't walk in and get 9 ounces of heroin without having some kind of relationship. Harris testified they didn't just let people in off the street. There's no evidence to support that somebody could just walk in and get 9 ounces. If I may, I'll address the other issues raised by Mr. Deaton. In terms of the expert, the testimony that was offered by the district court didn't abuse its discretion with regard to the last point, its broad discretion in admitting the co-conspirator statements. In addition, the district court did not abuse its considerable discretion by allowing Detective Clay, a 28-year veteran who had engaged in hundreds of narcotics trafficking investigations, including undercover work and long-term investigations, to testify to methods used by drug dealers. That's not controversial in terms of the law of the Eighth Circuit, and his testimony was confined to the parameters of what's admissible under Eighth Circuit case law. In addition to that, to the extent that Mr. Deaton challenges the record on the qualifications of Detective Clay, the record supports his qualifications. I also note the case we cited in our brief at page 48, Holmes, that says with regard to drug profile experts, not necessarily, Daubert does not necessarily apply to every aspect of their testimony as set forth.
Drug profiling, or was this sort of M.O. type?
It was M.O., Your Honor. If I said drug profiling, I apologize. It was modus operandi. It was very standard testimony in terms of what's permissible under cases like I believe Robertson, Kelly and Robertson that we've cited in our brief. There was nothing about this that was out of the realm of the ordinary in terms of explaining to a jury, giving them information to assist them in evaluating the way drug dealers operate. These are things that regular jurors don't know. It's outside the scope of their knowledge. And a qualified expert in this case testified to things that would assist the jury in understanding the evidence. And if I may, just to touch on briefly, I know my time's running out. The record, again, I'll say Mr. Deaton engaged in an aggressive motion practice. We disclosed the World Series related discipline of two officers who testified in this case. And we're in front of a meticulous magistrate, Judge Nose, and a very experienced, meticulous district judge, Judge Weber. Their findings on dockets 276, Judge Nose's R&R, and Judge Weber's memorandum adopting Judge Nose's R&R are very specific. They engage in an analysis as set forth by this circuit in the Beck case, which dealt with, as Judge Weber put it, exactly the same issue. They found the probative value was virtually negligible. Judge Nose pointed out these events occurred almost 9 years prior to the trial. And in addition, Judge Nose also noted there was no suggestion of systemic or a repeated series of improper acts by the officers. So the actual decision itself is supported by Beck, and this was a Beck analysis. The judges did not abuse their discretion when they followed an Eighth Circuit opinion that, as Judge Weber put it in his memorandum and order, docket number 287, raised exactly the same issues presented in Beck. So there's no abuse of discretion there. And with that, I thank you, unless there are any questions.
I see none. Mr. Deaton, your rebuttal?
Yes.
This isn't a case in which the defense is nitpicking the government's evidence. The defense presented its own evidence, including a canine officer who came in and testified about how a dog alerted to where Leah Douglas was sitting in the passenger side of the car. If Leah Douglas's testimony had been truthful, that dog would have been, this was Casey Peebles' car. The dog would have been alerting to the steering wheel and the front seat. The abuse of discretion here, again, it's because even though certain kinds of evidence had been admitted in other cases, that doesn't excuse the judge from not doing the analysis and of probative value and prejudice and those sorts of things to determine if the evidence should be admitted in this particular case. And as for the subsequent drug seizures, again, no evidence connecting Casey Peebles after April the 2nd. My time is up. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Deaton, and thank you for serving under the Criminal Justice Act and representing your client. Appreciate
it. You're welcome.